From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Gretchen Whitmer says her running mate will be Detroiter Garland Gilchrist.
I think he's definitely closer to the progressive wing. Today he expressed support for a federal single-payer health insurance, and that's not something that Gretchen Whitmer necessarily embraced.
The state of Michigan mounts murals in the Windy City to lure Chicagoans to Michigan's big cities.
So we wanted to say to them, listen, we have a big city experience to offer to. Different than Chicago, though, but just as rewarding to enjoy as a traveler.
And the little Detroit girl who discovered horses and then grew up to become MSU's rodeo queen.
It was kind of a thing that they couldn't talk, but they understood how you felt. Like, you didn't have to say how you felt around a horse.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Gretchen Whitmer announced her choice for running mate. Garland Gilchrist II is the Director of Social Media Responsibility at the University of Michigan School of Information.
So we're going to roll up our sleeves. We're going to add to the strength of the Whitmer campaign that's been making phone calls and knocking on doors for more than a year. And we're going to add energy to that using technology and the ways that people communicate, text messaging, social media, the things that I've learned to be able to mobilize people. And I'm excited about it.
Here now to explain just what this technologically savvy running mate brings to Whitmer's campaign is Chad Livengood of Crane's Detroit Business, one of the first reporters, if not the very first reporter, to call it for Gilchrist. Chad, tell us about this candidate. He is not in government now, but he has run for office?
Yeah, he ran for city clerk last year and narrowly lost by one percentage point to the incumbent clerk, Janice Winfrey. There was a recount, and he really took a lot of people by surprise in Democratic politics, created a real groundswell, grassroots-type campaign that sought to unseat a pretty safe incumbent. And people kind of saw that he's a pretty charismatic guy. He's got a different background and experiences. He's a computer science engineer, graduate of University of Michigan, native Detroiter, whose parents, like a lot of middle-class black families, left the city when he was a kid so they could get better education in the suburbs. And then he left the state. He went to work for Microsoft in Washington State. Then he moved to Washington, D.C. and got involved in politics, working for MoveOn.org. Kind of an unusual pathway to be the nominee for lieutenant governor. Most are lieutenant governors in Michigan in recent decades. And I went back and basically post-war. Every one of them has either come straight out of the legislature or was a U.S. attorney or was a member of Congress. I mean, we never have had anybody just kind of out of the private or nonprofit sector come in and be the lieutenant governor. So this is an unconventional choice for Gretchen Whitmer.
And he had worked for the Duggan administration?
Yeah, he spent about 3 or 4 years in the Duggan administration working in IT. That's kind of how he came back to Michigan. He was part of a group of expat Detroiters who basically kind of made these pledges that they were going to get back to the city eventually. Him and his wife made the choice that they have twin children, and after their kids were born, he found a job working for Beth Niblock at the City of Detroit in the Information Technology Department, working on trying to renovate and innovate new tech apps and various services for the citizenry in Detroit that have long had these really archaic systems. So he was really involved in that. He's credited with kind of pushing the needle on that front, and that got him into wanting to run for clerk, trying to improve what is always been, sort of derided as a really poorly run agency. That's why he's kind of a technocrat, and he really presents himself that way. And Whitmer likes that because, she spent 14 years in the legislature. One of her big pieces of her resume running for governor here is, as she said today, I've got more experience in the legislature than the last two governors combined, referring to Rick Snyder and Jennifer Granholm, who never served in the legislature. So she really downplayed Garland's lack of experience on that front because she's got that experience, basically. And so it's an interesting dynamic. And at the same time, you've got a young, mid-30s African-American. On the Republican side, you're going to have a young, mid-30s woman in Lisa Posthumous-Lyons as the lieutenant governor nominee. So we got some interesting interesting age, gender comparison to look at between the two tickets.
There's been this interesting thing to watch for in the Democratic Party between the mainstream Democratic Party and the progressives, you know, the ones that went for Bernie or Abdul el-Sayed. Where would you say Garland Gilchrist is on the progressive scale?
Yeah, I think he's definitely closer to the progressive wing. I mean, today he expressed support for a federal single-payer health insurance, and that's not something that Gretchen Whitmer necessarily embraced during the primary. She stayed away from that while Abdul el-Sayed really pushed that. And he wanted a state level, which she said was basically, you know, not really realistic to accomplish at the state level. So, and he worked for MoveOn.org when he was out in Washington, D.C., obviously a very liberal, progressive group that has focused on a lot of different types of policy changes that are, you know, to the left. If he has a record, that's basically it, because, you know, he worked as sort of a bureaucrat in city government, you know, didn't obviously serve in any elective office where he would have taken votes, whereas Lisa von Stumitz-Lyons spent 6 years in the House and took many votes, and some many of which the Democrats will probably try to use against the shooting campaign this fall.
Being one of the first journalists, probably the very first to mention Garland Gilchrist as a potential running mate, that was back in April. Did you get any sense that there was any consideration to go with a woman for a running mate to make it a 100% female ticket?
No. I mean, so after the Democratic endorsement convention, when Democratic activists sided with Dana Nessel to be the attorney general candidate over Pat Miles, the former U.S. attorney in Grand Rapids, there was a clear, concise effort on behind the scenes that needed to get an African-American and a male. So some gender balance, but particularly they needed an African-American from Southeast Michigan who could help solidify the vote, and not just Detroit, but also the suburbs. I mean, people forget, you know, 1 in 5 voters in Oakland County is an African-American voter. There's a, you know, constituency of Democratic voters, and the Democratic Party has had a long history of having at least one African-American on their ticket. Now, the Republicans this year have an African-American candidate at the top of their ticket, in the U.S. Senate candidate John James. So that was really kind of the why Garland Gilchrist, I first learned he was kind of the front runner, so to speak, behind the scenes back in April. And just one of those things you pick up as a tip on the street.
Chad Livengood, Crane's Detroit Business. Thanks, Chad.
Thank you.
Everything old is new again. That adage comes to mind when you hear about a new business in West Michigan called Lakeshore Game Night, door-to-door delivery of board games. Owner Jared Lietzo is with us. Jared, you describe your business as the Pizza Hut of board games?
Yeah.
So tell me, how does this work? Let's say I've got friends over on a Thursday night and we're looking for something different to do besides watch TV, and someone says, hey, let's play a game. Then what happens?
Basically, what you can do is you can look us up on my website. You go to the games available tab and you scroll through. I have about 50 or 60 games you can scroll through. You find one you like, call me, text me with your address, and I'll deliver it right to your house.
Where'd you get this idea?
It's kind of hard to explain. I guess I was aware that some other places were doing board game rentals. I didn't grow up on the west side of the state. I grew up in Flint, and the local game store there was renting out games. And I had the idea that when I moved out here that, you know, maybe to save myself some money and some retail space to just kind of deliver the games direct to the consumer.
So what kind of board games do you carry?
We carry a variety of board games. I'm trying to kind of cater to a wide variety of people and a large audience, and not just the traditional hobby style gamer or the typical, you know, board game you would find at like your Target or Walmart. So we have all your favorites like Monopoly, Clue, Risk. And then we have some of the newer, I would say, classics like Settlers of Catan and Ticket to Ride. And then just any variety of games, whether they're party games or more strategic type games. We offer just all sorts of categories, I guess.
So from ages what to what, would you say?
Ages toddler to adult. We offer some free games for younger age kids like Hungry Hungry Hippos and Operation. There aren't quite as many for that age range, but I realize, you know, sometimes you're like a babysitter might have some kids that they need to interact with or find something to do. So we offer, if you're within Muskegon County, you can get free kids games. So
yeah, and I see that you serve Muskegon County and parts of Oceana and Ottawa counties. And rather wisely, all games are rented for 3 nights. So you can, you know, kind of dive in and play for a few nights. And then do you come back and pick them up?
Yep, exactly. I come back and pick them up.
So. Now, what kind of response have you been getting from people?
I'm trying to kind of establish myself. So we're pretty new. We're getting a lot of interest online, and a local game group in Muskegon has been really helpful in helping to promote us and get the word out about us.
Now, I know this is not your full-time gig. So this is just what made you say, you know what, I'm going to do this as kind of a side gig?
I found this hobby and I found that I really enjoyed it, but it can be pricey. Some of these games can be anywhere from $30 to $100. And I really enjoy board games. So I thought if I could find a way to help people save money and try these games before they buy, and in turn, they would maybe pay me a little bit and help me fund my unhealthy obsession.
I'm thinking, Jared Leto, so that idea of everything old is new again. Are you on to something? I mean, what do you think people get from sitting around and playing, let's say, Monopoly, like when they were kids? Are people hungry for a low-tech way to spend time together?
I believe so. And I mean, I know I personally am. I work as a newspaper reporter, and I know as you being a reporter, you probably, a lot of your job probably involves sitting in front of a computer, looking at your phone. And I just think there's a huge disconnect. So I think the appeal is that it's actually a thing you have to take time to sit down and do with someone and interact with them face-to-face and not over something like Facebook or email or Twitter.
So, and you get a group of people together and call you up and you'll deliver Cranium, and then suddenly you've got people doing things together instead of looking at, instead of thumbing through phones and the like.
Yep.
What is your very favorite game?
The game that really kind of got me obsessed with board games is this game called Pandemic. And it's just a cooperative game. It's not competitive. You work as a team to basically play against the game itself. Then my other favorite game is probably a lesser known title called Scythe, which is a more of a strategic type game where you do compete with each other and try to score points and fight with each other. So,
Jared Leto, on to something here with Lakeshore Game Night, covering parts of West Michigan, branding itself as the Pizza Hut of board games. And we put a link to Jared's site up on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Jared, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll learn how one Michigan State University student went from growing up in Detroit to becoming the MSU Rodeo Queen. That's in about 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We lost the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, last Thursday, August 16th. And for countless fans of the King of Rock and Roll, that very same date in 1977 was, to them, the day the music died. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is back with us. And I think Elvis Presley's death is one of those I remember where I was moments for people who are of a certain age, shall I say. And then you look back, stop and think and realize Elvis Presley was only 42 when he died.
42. And yet if you remember the later Elvis, he was bloated and fat and sweaty and he wore those jumpsuits, those sequin jumpsuits. But he was a mere shadow of the beautiful, beautiful man they used to call Elvis the Pelvis.
Well, even in his comeback NBC special, he in the late 60s, he was young and beautiful. He was in that tight black leather suit. But here we are in 1977, and his fiancée, Ginger Alden, found him in his bathroom at Graceland.
Yep, collapsed right over the toilet.
And then he was pronounced dead at 3:30 that afternoon at Baptist Memorial Hospital, which you say was carefully chosen for being discreet.
Yeah, he had his own doctor, George Nicopoulos, and the Baptist Hospital, the doctors would do what they were told, as opposed to a much closer hospital where they were a little bit more blabby.
Okay.
And the autopsy was interesting. They did a cursory one, only a two-hour one. They tend to take much longer than that. Three doctors were involved, and one on his own, without the other two doctors' consent, said, Elvis died of a cardiac arrhythmia, which is, you cannot make that diagnosis unless somebody is alive and you have an EKG lead on them. And there were no drugs, repeat, there were no drugs involved.
Okay. And the other two doctors?
The other two doctors eventually said, well, there were drugs involved. A few weeks later, when the toxicology screen came back, it was filled with various opiate drugs, as well as quaaludes and antihistamines and laxatives. So he was taking a lot of drugs. And they also found evidence of a big floppy heart, probably of diabetes, type 2 diabetes.
Not surprising, considering his physical condition.
Exactly. Yeah. Glaucoma and evidence of a rip-roaring case of constipation.
Oh, boy. And and which you say comes from opiate use.
Opiates. One of the side effects of taking heroin or any opiate or opioid is that it stops the movement of the gut, peristalsis, and you become extremely constipated. And that was probably what led to poor Elvis's death. He was straining at stool so hard, creating what's called the Valsalva maneuver. You put so much pressure on your heart, on your aorta, that you can die of cardiac arrest. And it's an embarrassing way to go, but it's not an uncommon way to go among severely constipated people.
So leads us to, as we talk about his opiate use, he also abused, as it turned out, loads of other drugs?
Yes. So he liked quaaludes, which was a drug of abuse even then. Mm-hmm. He took antihistamines to sleep. He took benzodiazepines like Valium to be more calm. He took sleeping pills, barbiturates, laxatives, which can be abused, by the way. It was basically a pharmacy in his bloodstream.
Which leads us to focus a rather harsh spotlight on this doctor, Nick.
Dr. Nick was his nickname, and he specialized in the stars. He was also Jerry Lee Lewis's physician. And he admitted when he was brought before the Tennessee Board of Medicine that he prescribed perhaps tens of thousands of doses to Elvis. And he was concerned about his addiction, so sometimes he prescribed placebos. And he was most concerned that Elvis would go out on the street and buy street drugs, hence he prescribed them. And this was what's amazing to me as a physician, is that the Board of Medicine said, you know what? He was acting in the best interests of his patient. Not.
So they didn't pull his license.
Not that time. Yeah. He then came back before the board in 1980, and again he was acquitted. And it wasn't until 1995 that Dr. Nick had to hang up his stethoscope.
Almost 20 years after Elvis died.
And he was overprescribing for all of his patients.
And you know, as I thought about this, it is a sad story that we've seen claim other artists, Michael Jackson with his physician, Prince, Tom Petty, when there's a death, everybody's shocked and saddened, and then you find out there's just a pharmacopoeia of drugs in these people's systems.
Yeah. And they all have their own private physician on hire who make a great deal of money for taking care of that patient. And, of course, it seems like these stars are really getting bad medical care, and they are. And it is amazing that these doctors aren't put behind bars because they are absolutely violating their Hippocratic Oath and are culpable for helping to bring their demise. It's a terrible situation.
You also say that there was some, years later, some genetic detective work that suggested maybe some other disease things were at work.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. Some geneticists claim to have a lock of his hair. That's interesting in and of itself.
Can't verify that.
Yeah. And they found evidence of a genetic hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. This is a heart condition where the heart muscle becomes especially thick. It becomes floppy. It becomes damaged. And you can die of a sudden cardiac death with it, generally at a young age. So that is possible.
Because you said he did have a floppy heart.
He did.
He did.
And he had heart failure for lots. He could have had it for lots of reasons. He had hypertension. He was obese. And, you know, all of these drugs don't help your heart either. You slow things down. You speed things up. It's not good for your heart to do that.
As you say, a perfect storm of circumstances, medications and disease. And
all conspired to kill the music, as you said.
University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markel on the death of Elvis Presley 41 years ago. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Discovering a passion, chasing that passion, it can change your life in profound ways. Just ask Michigan State University student Kalila Smith of Detroit. She discovered horses as a young girl, and then she discovered the rodeo. Today, Kalila Smith is the 2018 Miss Michigan State University Rodeo Queen, and she is a groundbreaker, the first Black rodeo queen in the school's history. Kalila Smith, welcome. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And I see you wearing your Michigan State Spartan Stampede Rodeo Queen jacket with great, great pride.
I love to wear it. It's something that I have, like, it's my trophy now. So.
And I bet you're like, come on, everybody, ask me about this jacket.
Always.
Well, let's start at the beginning. What got you hooked on horses? Because I know you grew up in Detroit, which is not exactly the first city that pops to mind when you think of horseback riding or rodeos.
And so, that's what everybody says.
Yeah.
Like, where are you from? They expect me to be from some type of country town. But actually, being in Detroit has taught me a lot. And growing up in Detroit, we didn't have many options as to what to do. Of course, my mom always kept me in different sports to get the energy out. I was in karate, basketball, track. And it was just like none of them kind of caught my interest. I was in them to just be in them kind of thing. And then diagnosed with ADHD, she was trying to keep me busy also. So getting into horses was a kind of way that she knew I loved animals, and my passion for animals ended up being in horses also.
So how did you get connected with horses, and how old were you?
I gotta say I was about 8, and my mom snowmobiled, and one of her friends had horses. So she invited us to her barn, which is the Detroit Buffalo Soldier Heritage Center. And that's when I got to get to know horses. And like a couple weeks after, I was like, I want a horse. And then mom was like, So they said, if I volunteer for a while, get to know horses, get to know how to take care of them. I cleaned up after them. No matter rain, sleet, or snow, I was there.
What grabbed you about horses? What was it that spoke to you?
It was kind of a thing that they couldn't talk, but they understood how you felt. Like you didn't have to say how you felt around a horse. When they get near you, they're like, okay, what's wrong? Because my horse now nudges me and stuff like that. He can tell when I'm upset, he'll go to the far end of the pasture like, no, you're upset, we don't have to ride today. Or if I'm really sad, he'll come near me and kind of push me.
You mentioned ADHD. Mm-hmm. So how did getting involved in riding and in caring for the horses, how did that affect you?
It was kind of like a reward system. If I do good in school, kind of get the energy out in school, do my work, I got to see my horse at the end of the day. And I knew if I did bad in school, I wasn't able to see my horse. And that was kind of a thing that pushed me to do better in school. So my grades ended up skyrocketing, and then my horsemanship also.
And then where'd you find rodeos? What led you to that?
I'm a speed demon. So it's kind of like one of my trainers from Ridge Park introduced me to barrel racing on her horse, Gloria Turner, and she introduced me to barrel racing, and then she taught me all she knew. But then she has a closed head injury, so she said, I'm going to take you to a friend whose family been barrel racing and rodeoing since they were in the womb. So she introduced me to Keith Morrell, who is now my trainer, and I got my horse through him, and he's taking me through rodeo.
Now, people that kind of think they know what a rodeo is about, but really don't. So take us to a rodeo. What kind of competitions happen?
A rodeo is kind of like the rough part of horsemanship. It's like when you want to get down and dirty and you like the speed of horses and the agility, you kind of get into rodeo. So basically you have your timed events, which is roping, steer wrestling, tie down calf roping, barrel racing. And it's basically your race against time and other people's time and with the cleanest pattern with barrel racing. And then with the rough stock events is basically bull riding, bareback bronc, and saddle bronc, which is amazing to see how those guys ride.
And what drew you to barrel racing?
Again, I love speed.
And you love horses.
Yes. So put the two things together.
And so is it going around the ring? How are the barrels laid out?
The barrels are in a clover leaf pattern. So you can make a right and two lefts or a left and two rights, depending on which way your horse likes to run or which way you like to run. Get the smoothest pattern. If you knock down a barrel, it's 5 seconds added. So people try to keep them barrels up.
So the clock is ticking.
Yes.
Oh, boy. And tell us about that competition circuit, because I'm wondering, as you were out there competing, how diverse was the crowd?
Towards the north, not really. I'm kind of, me and Stacey Russell are kind of two peas in a pod, kind of, because when we go to a rodeo, it's just us there.
So she's another woman of color. Okay.
She's actually currently in the standings of the national bureau, like the national ranks. And then she's also mid-state ranks. So I look up to her very much. And then going to more southern rodeos, we actually see more blacks in the rodeo because as you get south, more black people participate in local rodeos. So
did you ever feel kind of lonely as you were starting out and looking around and not seeing other black faces?
Not really, because I've always had like a crowd around me, like my mom and my brother, and Keith always went with his family. So it was kind of like we all piled up in one truck and went.
And so you had your horse.
Nice. Yes.
Tell me about your horse.
I actually have two. It's a long story with this my first one. So I had a horse when I was about 12 or 13. My mentor gave him to me. His name was AJ. He was a Tennessee Walker. I think he was 18 the time I got him. So he was the one that got me out of my shell. And it kind of was a growing point for both of us because AJ was the horse that always stood in the back of the pasture, didn't want to be bothered with anybody. He didn't want anybody petting him, anything. And as I started playing with him more, he could hear my mom's old truck and immediately he runs from the back of the pasture to the front.
So you meant as much to AJ as he did to you.
Yeah.
And then what horse do you have now?
Mystery. My horse AJ actually died in my lap. When I was younger, yeah, I cried so hard. And then Mystery was his pasture mate. So when I brushed AJ and petted AJ, I brushed Mystery and petted her. So I end up getting Mystery. She is about 10 now, and she is a sweetheart. She's my Tennessee Walker. She's black and white, and she's gorgeous when she walks. And now I have my barrel racing horse, which is Blue. His paper name is Southern Blue Moon, but we just call him Blue. So I ride in blue and everything with him.
And there you are earlier this year, and you are named MSU Rodeo Queen for 2018. What does it mean to you? What does it do to your heart to be the first black woman to be able to wear that jacket and wear that sash and say, yes, I am the queen?
I love it because I know kids can look up to me, especially in places that they don't see public figures in places that they don't think they can participate in. And it's just like, I wear it and I tell people that I'm the first African-American because it's a big substantial thing, because it's like, you can come do this too. It's not just me who can do it. Like, it's not just me who's in this position just to be in this position to say I'm in it. But it's like, I want to bring others up and say, get in positions where there has not been any black people. Be the first black mayor of your county. Be the first black president of a club in your school. It's not hard. It's just, you have to put the motivation in. And I think that's where a lot of our communities lack, is the motivation to do things.
Kalila, when you're out there and you get off your horse after you've done your barrel race, and do you ever have youngsters of color come up to you at a rodeo and go, I want to do that?
Yeah, actually, I went to Georgia and a girl actually walked up to me and cried. Like, she was about, couldn't have been more than 5 years old. She walked up to me and cried. I picked her up and we took a picture together and it was amazing. I loved it. Her mom told me that she wanted to also ride horses, and I'm like, just get her into it. Meet somebody that has a riding facility around here, no matter where they are, get the commitment and actually take her.
Now, I know you're in the pre-vet program at MSU. What do you want to do in veterinary medicine?
I actually want to work with big, large exotic animals. So I want to go to the wildlife safaris and stuff like that and work on the wild animals. I think it's amazing to work in nature compared to captivity because you can actually see their homes and their niches and stuff like that.
How long do you see yourself barrel racing and competing in the rodeo?
A long time, because I haven't been able to do it much as queen because I've had other priorities with queen. But as soon as I give up my title, I'm going to go. I already told my mom, like, we're getting a truck and trailer and we're hitting the road.
What kinds of things have you been doing during these months since you've become queen? What have you learned?
I've learned a ton. Some people are amazing. And everywhere I go, it's always I pick up something. So far, I've noticed more people in the South are more open to a black rodeo queen because it's like they'd never seen one before in their life. Like, most of them are either tall, they're tall, blue-eyed, blonde hair, and skinny. And it's kind of like, they're like, you have changed everything that we see. So it's kind of like, I love that, because now I'm given the impression that more kids, you don't have to be skinny, you don't have to be blonde hair, blue-eyed, stuff like that.
I can tell you where that with ease.
Mm-hmm.
Like, being a groundbreaker, being a trailblazer, you like that.
I like it because I can sit back and kind of like, I'm not really the upfront person, but I can like sit back and let people see me and be like, okay, now you can do the go ahead. Like, I'm the one that wants to push everyone to do other things.
Well, and I have to imagine, because I'm a mom and I know your mom, I'm sure made a lot of sacrifices to get you out to the field so you could ride, to get you to the barn,
yes,
to buy the horse.
I love her for that, too.
She's sure this has to be such a thing for her to just, can't even put it into words, to see you be the rodeo queen.
Yeah, she's very, her and my brother and my granddad are very happy.
Kalila Smith, the 2018 Miss Michigan State University Rodeo Queen. As we have said, the first Black rodeo queen in the school's history, with her eyes set firmly on vet school. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Coming up, a new ad campaign by the state of Michigan is using murals, hoping to attract Chicagoans to visit, maybe even move to Michigan. Will it work?
For a long time, Detroit has been seen as something lesser than what you can get in Chicago. And let's just state it, Chicago is a great American city, but so is Detroit.
And our friendly reminder, we always love to hear from you. What stories are you focused on, or issues or people that you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook by searching for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, and always MichiganRadio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The state of Michigan has itself a new campaign to lure Chicagoans to our state. Instead of soft music and the dulcet tones of Tim Allen, this time they're putting up murals by Detroit artists in certain Chicago neighborhoods. Dave Lorenz is vice president of Travel Michigan, which is, of course, is part of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. So, Dave, this Seek Authenticity with capitalized city, it's a $1.2 million campaign, and what's the goal?
Well, the whole idea behind the Seek Authenticity program is to really wake people up to the fact that Michigan is not only a place where you can get to enjoy beautiful natural areas, but a place where you can enjoy nightlife and all the fun things that there are to enjoy in cities. You know, there was a time when people would run away when you start to recommend people going to Detroit. Well, those days are far gone now, and Detroit is becoming the biggest travel story in the country, let alone the biggest economic development story for a city in coming back and in the renaissance that that's going through. But we have other really interesting, cool, fun cities to enjoy in Michigan as well. And we just wanted to tell everybody, hey, we're proud of our cities, and you need to come and explore here.
What other cities is the campaign going to spotlight?
Initially, and we'll expand throughout into other cities down the road, but initially we include Detroit. We also include Ann Arbor and Grand Rapids and Lansing and Kalamazoo and Flint. And I want to say Flint specifically because that's one of those cities, when we say Flint, people might say, well, boy, that's a really economically challenged town, and they had the water issues and all that. Well, the fact is that you'll be surprised to see that Flint is one of these cities that's coming back, where this grassroots movement combined with city and state involvement is coming back and provides a really fun experience.
So through this campaign, you've partnered with a celebrated Detroit artist to kind of, you're beginning by creating and installing murals in Chicago. Tell us, who is this artist? What's he known for?
Yeah, you won't believe his name. It's a Sheafy McFly. Something tells me that wasn't his given name.
Somehow.
But you never know.
But it sticks in your mind.
That's right. It certainly does. His professional name, at least. And he's an artist that caught our eye a couple of years ago. He won the Art Prize competition in Grand Rapids. And my gosh, I can't believe I didn't mention Grand Rapids as one of our cities, our second biggest city.
Yeah.
And so Grand Rapids hosts this beautiful, wonderful, huge fall art competition called Art Prize, the biggest competition of its kind in the world, and they now do that every 2 years. Well, we met him there. He was one of the winners, and we were just impressed with his really vibrant, outgoing, bold statement that he makes through his art and his big murals that he makes. And we thought he might be a really good artist to interpret the city experiences that you can have in Michigan through a mural. So he put his mural design together, and it kind of incorporates everything from the city fun things like great places to go to eat and to listen to music and to find pubs and, you know, distilleries and craft beer and wine and all that. And he kind of brought that all together in this beautiful mural that also brings about other natural elements, the fact that we have millions of acres of forest and water everywhere and lighthouses and things like that. So we brought it all together to showcase Michigan cities and our authentic experiences that you can have all throughout Michigan.
And you've taken Sheafy McFly's mural and installed it in Chicago.
Yeah, kind of fun. So, you know, it's interesting that I think for a long time, Detroit has been seen as something lesser than what you can get in Chicago. And let's just state it. Chicago is a great American city, but so is Detroit. And I think, you know, a lot of the Chicago people for years have been saying, well, I'll look for other places to go to in Michigan, but we already have our own city. So we wanted to say to them, listen, we have a big city experience to offer too, different than Chicago, though, but just as rewarding to enjoy as a traveler. So Chicago, enjoy your city, and then come on over and see some of our cities as well. So we have the murals up in Uptown. We also have them in Wicker Park. And I'm hoping over time, as people go by those murals, they'll look at them as something more than billboards, something that's a little more permanent, something that talks to them in a different, more contemporary way. And over time, as they start to look at this and really explore what the artist meant through his interpretation of this, I think they're going to figure out that, maybe some of these places in Michigan are places that I should go and experience.
Do you have other markets in mind besides Chicago?
Well, we do. We haven't rolled them out yet, but over time, I think this is something that's going to grow. You know, the interesting thing is murals are starting to pop up all throughout Michigan, and Detroit is a great place, for instance. I think it was National Geographic, if I remember right, just actually wrote a story that if you want to see great American murals, go to downtown Detroit. But we also find murals are popping up all throughout the state in small towns, big towns, as a way to express through public art something about that community, the authenticity that community provides. And so it's a fun way for us to do this externally into other towns, invite them to come into our places, experience what you have, and of course they're going to find beautiful murals in our cities as well.
Dave, would you say the goal of this mural and this campaign, is it mainly to attract tourists to visit or talent to move here?
I think it's a combination of both of those. So I guess you could say it's about awareness and perception, because we need to remind people that Pure Michigan is truly a really, really special place. Outdoor experiences, indoor experiences, everything. So it's making people aware of that. But it's also to some degree changing perceptions. I mentioned Flint at the beginning of this, and for many years, Detroit as well, went through this horrible reputation. And I think for many years, a well-deserved reputation, to tell you the truth, because the cities were just falling apart. And what people need to experience when they come to these two cities specifically is the fact that it's amazing what can happen when people come together in a grassroots movement and they say, I'm not going to take it anymore. I'm going to take my city back and make it a great place to live, work, and play so that local people can enjoy the community and so can visitors. And that's what's happened here. That's the tremendous story that we're trying to get across. And I think it's not only interesting. It's inspiring. If cities like Detroit can come back after 40 years of decay, then any communities can. And that's what we're expressing here. And then, of course, we're also inviting people to come to these more successful cities like Grand Rapids and Ann Arbor and Lansing and Kalamazoo as well. All, interestingly enough, university towns, they tend to have this energy, this vibrancy. So as we move on, I think we'll be going to slightly smaller cities and inviting people to our downtowns there that offers a little bit different experiences as well.
In the meantime, Tim Allen can keep inviting us to the beautiful nature and lakes of Michigan.
He certainly will. And in fact, he'll invite you to our cities as well. He's a great guy. He loves Michigan, and we love working with him. He's as smart and funny as you would hope he would be, and we love working with him.
Dave Lorenz, VP of Travel Michigan. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Healthcare providers and policymakers in the Upper Peninsula have an important new tool. It's the first ever comprehensive assessment of the region's health needs. Over the past couple of years, researchers surveyed some 5,000 people spread over the region's 15 counties. They dug into published sources and talked with healthcare providers and then came up with this comprehensive assessment. Dr. Terry Frankovich is medical director for the Western Upper Peninsula Health Department. Dr. Frankovich, very good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So this assessment, it's a first. Why now? What was the spark that made this come together, and why was it needed?
Well, we actually, two of the district health departments in the UP had done a similar assessment for their district only over the last several years. And so we were able to work out the bumps a bit, and we found it incredibly useful for evaluating current status as well as planning for future needs, and thought it would be important to bring that tool to the entire UP. So it really will allow us to compare all counties in the UP, not only to national and state data, but also to each other.
And I know that the report talks about social determinants of health. What does that mean? And what's the key to that?
Well, it's really a way we look at public health now. Historically, the focus has really been on chronic diseases, you know, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, stroke, and looking at personal health behaviors that contributed to that health status. And now I think we're taking that broader look at the social determinants of health, meaning that the environments in which we live, work, go to school, and age really determine to a large extent the quality of our life and our health outcomes.
So based on the findings of that of all of this, the survey and all of the research that's been pulled together, what did you find? What are the top health challenges that the Upper Peninsula faces?
Well, I think, you know, the assessment itself is meant for the communities to look at and in part determine what they feel are their biggest challenges. We're providing them with the data to do so. But I would say that the main themes that we looked at or found in this assessment were, one, the impact of an aging population. We're getting old ahead of the national curve in the UP. And in fact, you know, nearly 20% of our residents overall are over 65 compared to the state. And in many of our counties, that's 30% of our population over 65. So obviously that has a huge impact on planning for future health needs for our communities. The importance of prevention. We know, of course, that the UP looks like much of the country with cancer, heart disease, diabetes, stroke being leading causes of death. And we know that curtailing just tobacco, obesity, and alcohol and other drug use would go a long way towards decreasing mortality and morbidity for UP residents. So we looked at those indicators specifically, so rates of tobacco use, rates of chronic diseases, rates of heavy drinking, so that communities have those numbers in their hands when they look at what they want to address within their own community.
And what did you learn about drug use?
Well, like the rest of the country and the state, we're facing an enormous opioid epidemic in the UP. In fact, we have the highest rate of neonatal abstinence syndrome in the state. And when we look at our respondents to our survey in terms of injection drug use and snorting drugs, we're certainly higher than the state as a whole. And many of our communities are quite high. The other health impact we've seen with that is a very high rates of hepatitis C in our young adult population, most of which is attributable to IV drug use.
And just so we're all clear, you talked about the highest rate of something to do with neonates. So with babies that are born, what's the highest rate and what higher than the rest of the state? What is that?
So we're talking about neonatal abstinence syndrome. So these are infants born to drug addicted mothers who themselves are drug addicted. And these infants typically have longer hospital stays, more difficult hospital courses. And of course, unlike some infants who have health challenges but are going home to families that are fairly stable, these infants are going home often to households facing enormous challenges because of parental substance abuse. So they're very high-risk infants.
Dr. Frankovich, what did you hear from people? What are they most worried about?
Well, actually, in this survey, we asked respondents to rate their the issues they felt were most important in their communities. So they chose from a list of 16 issues we had heard throughout the UP, and they ranked health insurance, the cost of it, as well as copays and deductibles, or lack of health insurance as one of the top priorities for their community. Drug abuse was also listed, as well as unemployment, wages, the economic conditions in the UP. And I think, again, this ties into the idea of social determinants of health. You know, health is much broader than what, you know, asthma and diabetes. It's really our communities, our workplaces, our homes.
So with this community health needs assessment in hand now, the first ever, very, you know, across the Upper Peninsula, what are some thoughts? What are some ways that health care providers in the UP can address these issues in a collaborative way?
Well, that's really the thrust of this, is to use it as a springboard for a community health improvement planning process. So that process will likely look a bit different in every county in the UP, but the idea is using the health departments in part as leaders in this process, pulling together stakeholders and community members to look at the findings of the assessment and to prioritize needs and look at resources in their communities. The funders for this included, you know, multiple entities, 32 in fact, across the UP, as well as some foundation funding that helped support the process. And I think as these communities go forward with health improvement plans and programs, they'll be looking for funding from some of these entities to help support those improvements.
And are there some problems or some challenges that really could be better addressed through local or state or federal policy, that it's more than a health department can do on its own?
Well, there are certainly some overarching issues, for instance, health insurance. You know, the health departments and our local partners in terms of hospitals and community mental health, et cetera, you know, we can't on our own change that structure, but we're quite concerned because we've seen a drop since the Affordable Care Act came into place. We had a drop from 18.5% of adults uninsured to 7%. With the proposed changes, or at least the discussions, we're concerned that that's going to change. And that's something that's, you know, beyond our scope in terms of improving, but we'll need to respond to those changes as they occur.
Were there any surprises for you in the results of this assessment?
Well, I think that you know, we had never really gotten much in the way of data on some areas like mental health and substance use previously. So having the opportunity to really see that data was important. I think mental health, it was profound to us looking at this. We are so underserved in terms of psychiatric care in the UP. You can ask any primary health care provider and they will tell you that, because they're really taking up the brunt of the psychiatric care in terms of medication, certainly. We have a 39 inpatient beds in the UP and 8 full-time psychiatrists, and by our population, we should have about 155 beds and 31 psychiatrists, so we're very short, and there is no inpatient pediatric psychiatric care in the UP at all. So children have to go out of state or downstate to receive care.
Certainly a lot of insights in this, and we've been talking with Dr. Terry Frankovich, the medical director for the Western Upper Peninsula Health Department, on the first ever community health needs assessment done in the UP. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And that's our program. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin. Our engineer was Mike Blank, and our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, and Sophie Sherry. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.